I'm CJ. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me? Is everybody okay? Anybody can't hear me? My sobriety date.
Put the microphone closer to your mouth.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
My sobriety date is 5/31/04, so I have 10 years. That's a big deal. 9 months is a big deal. How many years did we say you had? 143 and 9 months. We were just saying that. So awesome. Good job, everybody. So my dad does this. And one of the things that he said to me when I was talking to him yesterday was that there's three kind of AA talks you'll give. The one you're going to give, the one you give, and the one you wish you gave.
Yes.
So I'm really not sure how this is going to turn out. And I'm going to say a lot. So I guess a little bit about how it was. I was alcoholic probably from birth. My dad's alcoholic. My mom is probably alcoholic. I was born in Richardson, Texas. My mom and dad got divorced when I was about 6 months old, and my mom decided to move us around Texas a little bit, and then we moved to South Africa. And we lived in South Africa for about a year. My mom met a man named Raymond, who, it was 1979, and I was 4 years old, and he was a diplomat in South Africa. And as far as I understand, the story goes that she asked him, or he asked her to marry him, and she said no. So he took our passports and declared us illegals. We were in jail in South Africa in 1979. And the way that it went was that there's three cells, and my sister and my mother and I were each in a different cell. My sister's 7 years older than me and is obnoxious. She was obnoxious then as well. I love her. And she's screaming at the guard, you know, you don't know who I am, and my daddy's going to come get you or something, I'm sure, obnoxious. And the guard hit her with the butt of a gun and knocked her out. I was four. My dad is in Texas. He's looking for us. He doesn't know where we're at. He called some private investigators, did some stuff. I don't know what happened. Anyways, he came to South Africa. He broke us out of jail or something, and we go get on a plane, and I have this green blanket at home that they wrapped me in, and they put me under the seat of the airplane, and the idea was that the guards were looking for a woman and two children, and that they wouldn't be looking for a man and a woman and one child, so they stuffed me under the seats. And what I do remember is that the guards were walking up and down the plane, and that they stopped in front of where we were, probably to talk or look at somebody, but all I saw was that they stopped and scared the pee out of me. Remember that. We flew back into New York, and it was the first time and the last time I've seen the Statue of Liberty, and it was probably the best thing I've ever seen. So that was my first experience of chaos with my mom and my sister and my dad. We get back to Texas, and then my mom decides we're going to go to Hawaii, where we went, and we lived there for a little bit. We lived everywhere in Hawaii. We lived with in Buddhist colonies with Hawaiian priests up in the mountains, down on the beach. She was like Cher in that movie Mermaids, where you would throw the dart at the map and we would just go there, and we just went. My sister kind of started going to a boarding school when she was in ninth grade, so she went to Mid-Pacific Institute on the Big Island, so she kind of escaped. She got a little bit of the stability that would have been nice. And I didn't. I was a menace. And I did everything I could to make my mother's life miserable, which sucked. Horrible abuse that I don't need to go into happened when I was real young. And I started drinking when I was 12. And I drank because I needed to quiet the voices in my head. I needed to stop the world. I needed everything to just calm down. I couldn't handle, I couldn't function. I didn't know how. And I can remember that first beer. I was driving down the street with at 12 years old with a, you know, guy probably 25 years old. And we're in Hawaii and he hands me a beer and I drank it and it was like, you know. And I was a terror from that point on. At one point, when I was in ninth grade, my mom and dad talked and they decided I was going to go to Dallas to live with my dad. And the only thing my dad had to do while I was in Dallas, he's an alcoholic in recovery, and he had been working with his recovery since I was probably before I was born. And the only thing he had to do while I was there was not drink. That was the only thing. Don't drink. And he got drunk. And I found a 12-pack of Coors Light as he was walking in the house, and I poured it all out, and I called his sponsor and a couple other of his friends, and my dad's a big Texas businessman, and it was the first time I had ever seen him cry. I was sitting at this leather chair behind this big oak desk, and he was in tears, and I looked at him and I said, "You don't love me. You're a weak, weak man, and you chose alcohol over me." I got back to Hawaii with my mom, and they didn't know what to do with me, because I'm a menace, still. And my mom wanted to send me to Europe to a preparatory academy in Salzburg, Austria. And my dad wanted to send me to my uncle in Roswell, New Mexico, to the New Mexico Military Institute. Which, my personality, I probably would have loved. But I ended up going to Salzburg, Austria. And I got there in December. I was 15, and the drinking age in Salzburg, Austria is 16, so I had about a month to get my bearings straight. And I started drinking. And I drank my way through the last year of preparatory academy. I have pictures of being at the beaches of Normandy. I have pictures in front of the Eiffel Tower. I've skied the Swiss Alps. I've been to places that I could only dream of being, and I don't remember being there. I compacted my spine skiing drunk, so, you know, I've made better choices. They sent me back to my mom in Hawaii with a note that said she's not welcome back. We don't want your money. Not bring that kid. My mom didn't know what to do. My dad was in the depths of his drinking. And so my mom, she did the only thing that I think that she could do, and she decided that she was not going to be a mom anymore. My name is now Rosemary, and I'm not your mother, and good luck. And so I moved in with a boyfriend, and that was the beginning of moving in with the boys and doing this constant codependence. So I met a man when I was 18 or 19. He's 14 years older than me, and he had just gotten out of a 15-year maximum security prison sentence. And I moved him in with me because this made perfect sense. And I was dating his brother at the time, so first we had to move his brother out. And so I moved him in with me, and the relationship with the brother was abusive. The relationship with the brothers was abusive. We were together for 12 or 15 years. And I remember calling my dad in Dallas, because I'm still mad at him, you know, because he's still a weak, weak man, and you chose alcohol over me. And I called him up and I said, "Guess what? I just met a man. He just got out of prison. He's 33 years old. I was 19. He's moved in with me," and I hung up. And he's in Dallas and I'm in Hawaii, and he doesn't know how to get a hold of me. And my mother is running from someone, heading up to Canada. And so that was the beginning of my first, that was my marriage. That was the beginning of my marriage. When I was 21, we got married. And when we got married, my dad had come down to Hawaii, and he tried to do everything he could, physically and financially, with intimidation. He could, just couldn't get rid of this guy, and which I would say was to my attribute, but it probably was just better though. I don't know. He just didn't have any place else to go. So he comes down and he sits in the car, and I can remember that my soon-to-be husband was in the front seat with my dad, and I was sitting in the back seat, and my dad said, "Please, please, please, don't ever take a drop of alcohol. It will ruin your life." And I knew that he knew I had been drinking for a while, but we had never really talked about it. It wasn't something that we spoke of. And I was just thinking, I got this. Like, I'm good. My life is under control. Life is good. You know, I mean, I'm fine. So, of course, I continued to drink. And in the big book, it talks about periods of sobriety and qualifying ourselves as alcoholics. And one of the things that I thought was that I was an alcoholic because I could go for a time without drinking. So I thought, well, I'm okay. I did that when I got pregnant with my daughter. You know, I did the whole body detox, and I wouldn't have a drop of alcohol, and I quit smoking, and I did all this stuff, but I was neurotic, and I thought about that day when I would finally finish nursing her, when I could finally start drinking again. And that was what it talked about in the big book. And the one thing that I had in me was that I remember towards in the midst of my working the steps, one of the things that I had thought was, well, I can go for a period of time without drinking, so I must be okay. And that got lost when I read that, when I read about how we either drink or we think about drinking. And so anyways, I drank until I was 29, and you know, just chaos ensued for that entire time. And by the time I got to my late stage drinking, I just wanted to die. I had a 5-year-old little girl. I was mean. I was a mean, mean, horrible mom. She was the only thing in the world that I could control. And I used intimidation. I would yell. I would scream. I would run at her. I never hit her. But for all intents and purposes, I was abusive. And the day that, and then I started going to school up at Peninsula College to be a chemical dependency counselor. Right? I started going to school to be a chemical dependency counselor, and at the time I was managing a 54-unit low-income apartment complex in Port Angeles, and you know, I thought I had my stuff together. And we were talking about alcoholism and the effects of alcoholism and people, and I kept trying to ignore the fact that we're talking about me. And it was horrible. It was a horrible, horrible, like I wanted out of this class. But my ego wouldn't let me go, because if I left, it would be obvious that I had a problem, so I had to stay. And so I went through this class, and there was a man in the class who I thought was kind of cute. And I'm married, and this is par for the course for me. This was just the kind of person I was. And he's talking about his alcoholism, and he had something, and I thought it was just, you know, like the cute guy, right? But he had something in him that I found attractive, and I couldn't figure out what it was. So one day he's talking about it, and I said, I think I might have a problem. I think I might be alcoholic. And that was the first time I actually kind of thought it. That weekend, I went home, and it was like Memorial Day weekend. Yeah, it was Memorial Day weekend, because 5:30, 1:04. And I drank all of the alcohol in my house, all the cooking liquor, everything I could find, I drank it. And my daughter was in the bathroom, and she had this really, really long, like she's Hawaiian, and she had this really, really long hair. And she's trying to brush it, and I'm sitting in the living room, and she's crying because the brush is stuck in her hair. And I'm just hoping that somebody's going to go deal with her, because I'm busy getting drunk. And nobody would go deal with her, so I went into the bathroom, and I'm trying to rake this brush out of her hair, and she's crying because I'm hurting her now. And I don't know what happened, but it was like an out-of-body experience. I'm above myself, and I'm looking down, and what I'm seeing is a hairbrush in one hand and my fist balled up in the other, and my her dad came in there and he grabbed me by the shoulders and he pulled me out of the bathroom and he threw me down the hallway and I hit the stove and the stove was on and my hand got burned and how dare you, what are you doing? Deal with that, you know, kid, and I'm going to go sit back down and get drunk. And the next morning I woke up and I realized what had happened. And I was supposed to be at this meeting to observe an AA meeting that night for class. So I'm trying to figure out how to go to this AA. I can't not go to the AA meeting because just like not getting out of class, I'd be admitting that I have a problem. So I have to go to the AA meeting. And I walk in there and I sit there and Oli, who's awesome, if any of you, there's a lot of time in here, you probably know Oli. Oli's sitting across the room and I'm listening to all these people talk and it just so happened there was somebody else there and it was their first meeting. And so they said that it was their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't going to say that. I wasn't going to say, this is my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody else did. So I'm sitting there and I'm listening to all these people talk about their story. And Oli gets to me and he says, do you have anything to say? And I said, I don't have the problems you all have. I haven't lost my family. I haven't lost my job. I haven't lost my mind. Everything's very, very precise and organized and everything is just so. And they all just kind of nodded. And there was this lady there and she had been talking about how she had lost her kids. That was one of her things. And she met me. Well, first, Oli walks by me, and he hands me one of those stupid pamphlets with the 10 questions on whether or not you're alcoholic. I hated that pamphlet. And the only question that I could not answer affirmatively to was the trucker question. There's a trucker question in there or something. Maybe I don't. And I've never been a trucker, so I couldn't say yes to that one. I can't remember how it worked, but I remember that. And when I went outside, that lady came up to me and she said, you have the option. You can get this process started now before you lose your daughter. And she had just talked about how she'd lost her daughter. And that really touched me because I was alcoholic. I loved my kid, but I didn't know how. And I hated myself more than I loved my kid, I think, at the time. So get this process started now. So when I started, what it's like, look at that, I did really well there. So what it's like now, the first 6 months of my time in AA, I white-knuckled it. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the big book. I went to meetings and I listened, and I think it would have been easier on my family. I was still married at the time. It would have been easier if I'd been drunk. Because I had energy and life sucked. And I was going through, I don't want to say I was going through detox because now I know what detox looks like, but I was really uncomfortable. I did not like who I was. I did not want to be where I was. And I hated anybody and everybody around me because it just was like a reflection of my inadequacies. And I was mean. I was meaner than when I was drunk. So I white-knuckled it. And the only thing that saved me was that person that I met at school said to me one day, he goes, well, why don't you meet me at a meeting? And I'm like, yeah. Okay. So I meet him at a meeting, right, down at the Carpenter's Hall. And he pushes me into the arms of a woman. And she was my first sponsor. And she saved my life. And I worked through the steps. And I didn't work through her opinion of the steps. I didn't work through her judgment of the steps. I worked through the steps as it's laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it saved my life. And there was talk of God and, soapbox for a moment. I didn't know how to handle that because I believed in God. I had a very elementary belief in God. God's the all-state hands, and I'm in them. And that was all I could think about. But And I remember saying once I wanted to be atheist, but God would be mad. Like, I don't know how that works. So I was really skewed on my impression of God and how to handle just the God topic. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Why am I in church? That seriously, that was a thing for me. And And I was allowed to come up with my own conception of God, and whether that be, you know, Holy Father, you know, on the cross, or good orderly direction, I was given the freedom to make that determination. And I'm so grateful for that. And over the years, it's changed, and it's grown into whatever I decided it is, you know, and now maybe it's not the Allstate hands, maybe it's the universe, or, you know, energies, or whatever source. I love that one. But whatever it is, it's my conception of God. It's not anybody else's conception of God. And that was a huge thing for me. I did the steps. I worked the steps through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I followed direction. I listened. Most of the time.
Yeah.
I love that Christina and Scott are here, because they were probably the ones that were around me the most in my insanity in the first few years. I listened. I didn't always follow directions, but I listened. I listened to what I was being told. Sometimes I did it. Sometimes I didn't. I think in my first 4 years of sobriety, I created more wreckage than I did in most of my drinking time. Everything was new. It was like a brand new world. I mean, I wasn't numb. And, but I wanted to save face, so I lied, and I manipulated, and I cheated. I cheated on my husband. I was a horrible wife. And I would lie to the people in the rooms because I wanted to save face. That's all. I just wanted to at least appear to be some semblance of a healthy human being. And I was so far from that, but that's what I wanted to appear to be like. And there was a pivotal moment when I knew that I could no longer be married to the man I was married to. I wasn't a very good wife. The relationship was, neither one of us were very good spouses. We both sucked at being spouses, and there was a lot of abuse, and I was looking at my daughter, and I was realizing that I was teaching her what was acceptable, and what was going on behind closed doors was not acceptable behavior, and we could no longer continue it. And I made a decision, and I remember that it was a decision, the first decision I made, where I had to stick with my decision, even though there were people who were like, "No, we stay married in Alcoholics Anonymous." And this is just my story. I say this very clearly. This is my story. This is what happened to me. And I remember that. I remember that there were, you know, families are reunited in AA, and that you know, this is what we do. We stay married. And I thought, you know, no, I'm not. I'm not going to do this. And it was the first time that I stood on my own two feet. And I made a decision that I knew in my gut was the right decision, even though it was one of the hardest things that I was going to have to do. I was going to have to face fear of being alone. I was terrified of the dark. I was afraid to be single. I was afraid of what kind of human being I was. What kind of woman was I going to be single? Was I going to be able to handle that? Because I wasn't sure that I was going to be able to handle that. I was afraid of financial insecurities. How was I going to be a single mom? Really? Like, this is what, this just can't happen. And I left, and I took my kid, and it was the best decision I made. In that process, my sponsor ended up changing. We just had a difference of opinion on what needed to happen in my life, and it was terrifying. And I also didn't want to get told what to do anymore. So it's funny because I picked a sponsor. I live in PA, and I picked a sponsor from SQIM because I knew that if I could get a not so long distance sponsor, that I could maybe skate by with doing what I wanted and still report back, save face. That didn't work out so well for me. And there was probably another 6 month period of time where I was without a sponsor again, and it was crazy. And this Thanksgiving, we had Thanksgiving dinner, and it's become a tradition in our house that we have cinnamon rolls for Thanksgiving dinner, because the first Thanksgiving dinner that we had, my daughter and I alone, she asked me if we were going to have a turkey, and I had burnt some cinnamon rolls, and I threw them across the room, and I said, there's your Thanksgiving dinner. And she's like 7 or something. And so now we apparently have to have cinnamon rolls every morning for Thanksgiving dinner. It's great. It's her way of reminding me. So, anyways, it was. I finally got another sponsor, and that was what I was always told was get a sponsor, work the steps, get a sponsor, work the steps, get a sponsor. And if that sponsor doesn't work, get a sponsor. This is my recovery. This is what I'm doing for myself. This isn't their recovery. This isn't my sponsor's recovery. And that's what I tell people when they come and work with me, and I'm their sponsor. I say, look, if it doesn't work for you and you don't want me to be your sponsor anymore, that is okay. Get a sponsor. Work the steps. And the only reason why I say this is because I watched what happened in my home when I didn't have a sponsor and when I didn't work the steps, and it was not okay. The only two amends that I made that were living amends are to my kid and to my ex-husband. And that one was hard because I felt like there was some justifiable, like, I get to be a horrible human because you were a horrible human kind of thing. That's not how this works. I was a horrible wife, so I can be the best ex-wife that I can be. And I still work on that today. And to my daughter, who is now 15 and is phenomenal. What it's like now, my first 5 years, I was cleaning up the wreckage of my past. My second 5 years, I was cleaning up the wreckage of my first 5 years. And there's a lot of wreckage. And, you know, the things that I learned, don't lie. Don't lie. Don't 13th step anybody. Legitimately, I mean, you know, that's a thing. That's a thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it doesn't matter if the person has 5 years and you got 10, it's really about being equally balanced. For me, it's just better if I don't date anybody in recovery. Works out that way. So, you know, but these are the things out there. Don't live vicariously through people who aren't in recovery or who are able to drink. It's funny, because that says what not to do. don't hide, right? So I'm open, I'm honest. There are people in my life, I have a sponsor and she knows everything. I have friends who know everything. And I may say something and I'll tell them, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm not telling you this so you can talk me out of it. I'm just telling you this because I got to tell somebody. Thank God that usually the telling of something gets me out of whatever I might decide to do. Not always, but usually. And don't take back control. When I did my steps, I released control over to my higher power. And every time that I think that I have a better idea than my higher power has for my life, I don't screw it up, the world's not going to end, there's no big explosion, but it certainly does set it back a little bit. You know, now I got some wreckage to clean up. One of the things that my challenge for myself was when I got out of my divorce, I spent a year single, but I really didn't spend a year single. I just didn't spend a year in a relationship with any one guy. It is what it is. And then I got into a relationship with somebody who was in the program, and he had a year and I had, I don't know, 5 or 6 or something. And he went back out. And we broke up. And I don't know what's going on with him, and I'm okay with that. I actually had to kind of start praying for him because that's a hard one. Because I got a lot of, like, wait a minute, you know. No, I signed up for that. So I did that for 3 years. I broke up with him, and I spent a year single. Yes. So that was a tough one. And in that year that I spent single, there was two times where I almost started dating somebody in the program again. New, like weeks, months. New. I got like years. And they are not ready, and I'm not signed up for this. And what ended up happening was I almost got drunk. I almost got drunk because I was so worried about my look good, right? And making sure that they didn't drink. So now their recovery is on my shoulders because I want to make sure they don't drink, because if they drink, then I'm proving everybody right and I can't do this. And it was exhausting and it wasn't worth it. During that time, I found out who I was. I started this journey of volunteering at the fire department. I didn't know what that was going to look like when I started it. But I went to North Bend, I went through my live fire training, and I got my Washington State certification as a firefighter. I went to school, and I became an EMT. And I didn't even think I was smart. I didn't think that I was smart. I was terrified to go to school because I didn't think that I was going to be able to learn something. And I did pretty good. And I thought that was kind of cool. And I started volunteering in Port Angeles at the fire department. I was working down at Westport as their bill of materials specialist. I got laid off. And my dad always taught me, you know, you lose a job, you get a job. So like the next day I had a job. I did not know that unemployment pays you more than the job that you get. So then I was pissed off because I'm like, wait, can I unsign the papers? Like, how does this work? Because everybody's like, don't get a job. Don't get a job. Go surfing for a summer. Go have fun for a summer. Go do nothing for a summer and collect money for it. And I thought, how could you guys not tell me this like an hour ago? But God works in mysterious ways. And if I had had a summer off, I would not be here to tell the story right now. There's just no chance. I needed the structure that was provided. And the fact that I got a job at like Counter Girl at Port Angeles Power Equipment, which is a great job. Any job is a great job, but it was just mind-numbing for me. I don't know anything about chainsaws. I don't want to go to school to learn about chainsaws. Ever. And that's what I was being asked to do, was like, if you're going to do this, do it well. So here, we're going to send you to school. I'm like, oh, dear. Pushed me into a different job, right? Because the best time to find a job is when you have a job.
Yeah.
So I found a job at the hospital, and I got a job in the emergency room as an ER tech. And in that process and finishing up with my EMT, I then started working at Olympic Ambulance. And so I'm an EMT for Olympic Ambulance, and I work as an ER tech at the hospital. These were things that I dreamed about being as a kid and didn't think I'd be able to do because I didn't think that I was smart enough, because I was told that I was stupid. Stupid, ugly, fat. Whatever. All of it. So how the heck, because I finally became the person that I was supposed to be, because I let myself be my own human being, because I gave myself a minute, just a minute. All I needed was a minute of just, nobody else is, just me. No guy telling me what I needed to do, just me. And my daughter, who when I started this journey was 5, is now 15. She suffers from something called PFN. Anybody know what that is? Pretty freaking normal. And she does not have this problem. And she may one day have this problem. And thank God that we are here and that there are people of all ages and philosophies and everything. Just like when I came in, my dad had brought me to AA meetings, and I felt comfortable coming to AA meetings, and I knew what it was like in an AA meeting, and it was a safe place in an AA meeting. And when I was a kid, I would sit in the fellowship room and eat all the sweet and low while he was in the meeting at the AA meeting. Like, it was, you know, it was a cool place to go sometimes. Except for there were all these women who were trying to pick up on my dad. No. Go figure. So I'm grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous is here, and I hope that she never needs Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to bring her to AA meetings, But at some point, in my opinion, she got too beautiful and I couldn't bring her to an AA meeting because it messes with my serenity, because I want to like stab people in the forehead for looking at her. I can't bring her anymore. I tried once and we were sitting down and I just shouldn't have even tried that meeting. That was the wrong one to go to. And I literally like picked her up and we walked out and I said, that's it, I'm done. You are never going to another AA meeting with me again. And she's like, what if I need it? And I'm like, well, by then you'll have other things going on. It won't matter. I'm my kid's hero today. And it is because of my higher power. It is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is because I work the steps. It's because I have a sponsor. It's because I'm honest. It's because I'm open and I'm willing. And I am so, so, so very grateful for that. And it says here what to do. And it was funny because I typed all this out, what not to do, but I didn't type out what to do. So I had to write that down at the end. Just want to make sure we all knew what not to do. Get a sponsor, grow, have faith, live for today. Use the tools in life. And that was something else that I learned, was that Alcoholics Anonymous is where I learn how to be a whole human being, and then I take that into my world. I don't make Alcoholics Anonymous my world, because that I consumed myself with drinking when I was with my daughter, and then if I consume myself with AA, she doesn't have me. And we went through that period, and she was sad, because even though her mother was sober, her mother was still never around. And so I learned to take these tools and use them in my life, and to be grateful. And I am so, so grateful. And it's funny because today I was sitting there and I'm at work in the ER, and it was a day. And I am wiping butts and cleaning beds and mopping up puke. And I'm trying to figure out what to be grateful for today. Huh. Like literally. And then at the end of my day, and this is no lie, we have a man come in and he's dying. And he looks at me and he goes, I really just want some ice cream. And we're not supposed to give them anything to eat or drink when we're doing testing, y'all. We're not supposed to give anybody anything when they're there for testing. And I looked at the doctor and I said, can we please just get that man some ice cream? All he wants is some ice cream. And I couldn't believe it. The doc said, oh yeah, that's fine. You can have some ice cream. So I went to the kitchen and I pulled a few favors. And I got this little cup of like vanilla ice cream, and I spoon-fed that man ice cream for 20 minutes. Because he can only take like a little bit at a time because he's dying. And I realized what I'm grateful for. I'm grateful because today I get to be a sober, healthy example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he may not live. He may not remember if he does live. But thank God for that. Because he got his ice cream. So that's cool. And I got to feed a man ice cream today, and I'm grateful for that. Really, that's all I got to say.